Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Hey, howdy, space nerds. If you're in the Orlando area, I've got an awesome event I want to tell you all about. I'm hosting a panel discussion here at WMFE on March 14th called The Future of Space Exploration from Florida. And there I'll be speaking with Kennedy Space Center Director Bob Cabana, a planetary scientist by the name of Addie Dove, and astronaut Nicole Stott. If you can make it, it is free. You're just going to visit WMFE.org/events to RSVP. But if you can't make it, don't worry. I'll post it as a podcast. Hope to see you there. From the studios at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, this is the Space Exploration Podcast that asks the question, are we there yet? Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. You've probably heard about exoplanets, right? Those planets that live outside of our solar system. The Kepler spacecraft has identified hundreds of these things, and some of those planets it's discovered are similar to Earth and reside in a zone around the host star known as the Goldilocks Zone, which means they could contain liquid water. Well, Kepler's about to get some help hunting for these exoplanets in April. The Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, we're going to call it TESS, launches into orbit from the Kennedy Space Center, and it hopes to find not just thousands, but tens of thousands more exoplanets. Earlier this week, I had a chance to visit TESS at the Kennedy Space Center. That's where the spacecraft is being prepped for launch inside a clean room. So for me to see it, I had to suit up in a full bunny suit and cover up my beard before I could walk in. I went through the air shower, and on the other side, I met up with Robert Lockwood of Orbital ATK. He's in charge of building tests.
Check one. Testing one, two. Testing.
Hi, Brandon. Hey.
So can you kind of explain what we're looking at here? I mean, this is a lot smaller than I expected to see. Can you tell me what we're looking at here?
Well, this is the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS. It's an Explorer-class mission observatory. Has four wide field of view cameras to search for exoplanets. It's a planet hunter. It's going to be surveying the entire sky in our nearby neighborhood in the galaxy to find stars that have exoplanets around it. That will then get followed up by other ground-based or space-based observatories.
This is always the toughest part for radio, but can you describe what we're looking at? Maybe start from the top and head down?
Sure, okay. So what you see on the top there, that conical shape, is a sunshade meant to block the sun from the cameras. The cameras also have lens hoods that block some more light on them. So there are four cameras up there on the top. Pointed out in the, again, for radio, they won't see this, but this is the test signature. The four cameras look like that. They're pointed like that. And so that's all cameras up on the top. They're sitting in a plate that just holds them there. Then everything below that line is what we would call spacecraft or spacecraft bus. It has all the components that service the mission, computer control, attitude control, power control, thermal control, those things, radios.
And then how does it transmit all that data back? Is there a radio dish on it somewhere?
There are. There are actually three antennas on it. The big dish that looks sort of like a sled that's facing away from us is a 3/4 meter high-gain antenna. That is for the Ka band system, the 26 gigahertz system. Its primary use is to transmit the science data down once every 13.7 day orbit. Then there are two S band antennas. That's at 2.2 gigahertz. That you see one on each side. That gives complete uniform coverage everywhere, so you don't have to point that antenna towards the Earth. You have to point the big high-gain antenna towards the Earth to transmit.
Now, how, from a weight perspective, how much does this weigh?
Well, in kilograms, it's 362 kilograms, fully fueled. That would be right at 800 pounds, 798 pounds. It has 100 pounds of hydrazine fuel in it, or 45 kilograms.
And how long have you been working on this?
8 years. George Ricker of MIT approached Orbital ATK 8 years ago looking for a spacecraft partner to propose this mission to NASA. We partnered up with him and developed the concept. It initially looked very different from that, but after a few little iterations, we came up with this compact design. That was then proposed to NASA. We got selected, did a concept study for them, and then implementation and all the things that lead here today, 8 years later.
And what were some of the challenges with a spacecraft this small?
Really none. This is a typical class for us. Again, we make larger geosynchronous communication satellites that are much larger that you've probably seen before. But this is a typical size for an Explorer class mission. So this is our LEO Star 2 product line, and this is a typical size and capability for that product line.
And finally, any pre-launch jitters or nerves? Are you nervous?
No, I'm really just excited. I'm ready to be there. Again, it's been 8 long years for me, so I'm really excited to be here, waiting for the day. Of course, a lot of people get all excited about the launch, but for us spacecraft guys, it's after that 10 minutes of launch when we're looking for our spacecraft to be operating on orbit. So that's really the exciting time for us.
I left the clean room of the Payload Hazardous Servicing Facility to chat with George Ricker. He's the principal investigator for this mission, and I've got to apologize, it's a bit noisy. There was another round of journalists and photographers suiting up behind us, so they would get their chance to see TESS.
Okay, so just give me the quick overview. What do we need to know about TESS? What's the mission?
Well, the mission is to carry out the first all-sky survey for transiting exoplanets that are in the solar neighborhood, and where we define the solar neighborhood as the distance out to 300 or 400 light years from Earth. This is an area that has not been explored extensively, and TESS has really been optimized in a way that it will be able to carry out that mission in 2 years' time.
Now, a lot of people that are probably listening are probably familiar with exoplanets because of the Kepler findings, right? Can you kind of describe the differences between Kepler and what TESS is looking to explore?
Right. Well, the way astronomers refer to these two different surveys, Kepler is an example of what we call a deep, narrow search, where you look at one small portion of the sky out to a very great distance. TESS, on the other hand, is referred to as a wide, shallow survey in which we trade off distance at which we look to solid angle in the sky. So if you're looking for phenomena associated with bright stars, if you go out and look at the night sky, the bright stars aren't all clustered in one particular point in the sky. They're spread evenly over the sky. So if you really want to be able to find planets associated with bright stars, you want to be able to look at the whole sky. And so that was the basic design concept that was underlying TESS.
So TESS is four cameras going to be pointed in the sky and looking at stars and waiting for them to dim, right? Why do you wait for them to dim?
Well, the dimming of the stars that we're looking at arises from the accidental alignment of the orbital planes. So the stars that TESS actually sees this dimming from are stars for which the planets orbiting them happen to be accidentally in the same plane as our line of sight to that star. And consequently, what happens is when the planet passes in front of its host star, it basically takes a bite out of the light coming from that star, because it basically blocks the photons from that patch for the period of time that it's moving across, and it produces a characteristic pattern that we recognize as a transit in which there is a shallow decay down to a floor, and then it's flat for a while, and then it rises again. This is a characteristic signature of a planet passing in front of its host star, and that was the same method that was used by Kepler.
What other information can you gather from that transiting and gathering the data from that?
Well, the main thing that you learn is the relative area, the projected area of the planet compared to the projected area of the star. And by a variety of means, we know typically what the size of the star actually is, so it's just a matter of simple arithmetic to determine how big the planet is. And once we've established the projected area of the planet, you know, planets are we expect them to be spherical, you calculate the volume, and then if you have a means of determining the mass of the planet, then you can determine what the density is. And if the number that you get for the density is comparable to water, that tells you that it might be a water world. If it's comparable to rock, which is about five times more dense, then we have an expectation that it could be a terrestrial planet. The other piece of that second piece, though, of determining the mass is something that typically has to be done by spectroscopy, and that's done by actually looking at shifts in the emission lines that come from the star itself. There's another piece of information that we can detect from a transiting system, which is that when the light from the star is actually passing through the outer layers of an atmosphere, if a planet has an atmosphere, there's a signature that gets imprinted on that light.
Oh, wow.
That we can use to determine the composition of the atmosphere. And that's another thing that's really important about the types of planets that TESS will be able to discover, because with the with those signatures, that's again a very small effect, and you really need a bright planet behind, a bright star behind it in order to produce the light source, and that can only really be done well with stars that are in the solar neighborhood.
Now, with Kepler, correct me if I'm wrong, you probably have better information than me here. I mean, Kepler has helped discover at least 1,000, 2,000 exoplanets, right?
Right.
Where is the projection for TESS to help discover?
Well, the number of Earth-sized planets and super-Earth-sized planets that TESS is expected to discover ranges from, depending on models and simulations, between 500 and 1,000. Earth or super Earths are planets that are approximately two or three times larger than the Earth. We don't happen to have a planet like that in the solar system, but they're actually pretty common, and there are planets that could have an atmosphere, and if they're in a habitable zone of their star, which means that you could have liquid water on their surfaces, they could very well be habitable planets in that sense. So those are both areas that TESS would be able to find. In terms of Kepler, in terms of total numbers, we would expect somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 total.
Oh, wow.
Planets that would be detected. Most of those planets would be large. They would be Saturn-sized or Jupiter-sized planets, but they will be there, and we will find them. The other thing is that if TESS operates for much longer than its standard mission, we will be able to find additional multi-planet systems. And for many of the types of systems that we're looking for, which are associated with red stars, so-called red dwarfs or M dwarfs, that are cooler than our sun. It turns out that they have a much greater incidence of multi-planet systems compared to stars like our sun. So this is something that we're really looking forward to exploring and seeing whether that's indeed the case or not.
So the projections say 10 to 20,000 exoplanets in just the 2 years that you're
right.
slated for this mission, right.
Right? Right.
So if the mission does extend, I mean, that's a waterfall of new scientific information.
It certainly is, yeah. And that'll be, and since these planets are associated with bright stars, there's going to be a lot of opportunities for follow-up observations in future space science missions, as well as ground-based telescopes. Mm-hmm. These large 30 and 40 meter ground-based telescopes that are coming online within the next decade.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just an incredible the amount of data that you're hoping to discover. I mean, is this new for... I mean, exoplanets have just come into the mainstream, obviously, with Kepler. But, I mean, has this been something that's kind of just taking off now with all the tens of thousands of planets? I can't get over that. I mean, are there scientists lining up to study these?
They are indeed. As part of the test science team, there's approximately 20... research institutes and observatories around the world that are going to be dedicating their time to actually providing follow-up. And then for the upcoming Webb telescope, which will launch next year, TESS has been designed so that it will provide optimum targets for that mission as well. And Webb, of course, will be very powerful for trying to understand the atmospheres of the planets that we actually discover.
And why is this an important field of science to be working in?
Well, I think it goes back to this question of that you hear sometimes phrased as, are we alone? And that might not necessarily mean that there are biological systems on these planets, but it's a step toward that thought, and it's a step toward that thought in the sense that if we know that there are other planetary systems that we could conceivably live on, then that's one way of thinking about the problem of is there life elsewhere. TESS will not necessarily find that, but TESS will find the targets that can be searched to answer that very basic question.
And finally, TESS is being prepped here at Kennedy Space Center for a launch in April. Any pre-launch jitters? What's going through your mind?
Well, there are always pre-launch jitters, but at some point you become, I wouldn't say fatalistic, but you've done everything that you can to make sure that the instrument and the satellite are completely checked out and every piece of it is operating the best that you can make it. And then at that point, you turn it over to the rocket team and they do their work. And then when you get into orbit, then you check it out and make sure that it's operating the way that you would expect it to operate. And that process will take us about 2 months after launch.
And can you put into words what it's like seeing an instrument that you've put so much time and effort into sitting in this high bay getting ready to launch in just a few weeks? What's that going to feel like?
Well, I mean, it certainly is an exciting culmination of the effort that's been made by a huge number of people. You know, we've made estimates that there's more than a million person hours that have been devoted to this effort, and just the excitement that everyone is feeling right now. I certainly share that excitement, and it's a sobering responsibility that we have to do the very best that we can to make this mission as successful as possible.
Wonderful. I'm excited to follow along with you. Thanks for speaking with us, George.
Yeah. Thank you.
Be sure to follow TESS on Facebook and Twitter. The team is sharing quite a bit of info and photos online. Well, that's going to do it for this episode, but join the conversation online. We've got a Facebook page ourselves. Search for Are We There Yet Podcast. Or you can take it to Twitter. The show is at AWTYMars. Are We There Yet Mars? Get it? And I'm at Space Brendan. Support for Are We There Yet comes from the listeners of WMFE. Our theme music was composed by Kevin McLeod. You can find more space news online at wmfe.org/space. And until next time, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.